So I basically can summarize my presentation by saying I agree with all the past speakers. Maybe the biggest difference between what I'm going to tell you and what you've heard already is that where a lot of people have said they see the glass half full, I see it half empty. I think, you know, the trends are moving in the right direction, but we need to be moving faster, and we are working from such a low level of capacity on average nationally that we really need to jump up to the next level. So how do I do this? There we go. So here's more, you know, how do we spend the money statistics. We looked at the last 3 years of allocations under the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, EQIP, and found that on average there was about 2.4% of our national allocation. And this is out of, you know, $700-800 million. So this is the biggest program for working farms. This is the biggest farm bill conservation program aimed at helping producers actually adopt environmental programs and practices on their farms. And overall, as you've already heard, that percentage is low. We also found that a lot of state EQIP programs are actually allocating zero or almost $0 for pest management, even in some of the states that are the most impacted by pesticides. So we're not seeing, you know, more the states with the biggest pesticide impacts funding the most pest management. This is a a little graphic which shows that, and this actually, the red dots are pesticide detections that exceed benchmarks for aquatic health or public safety or drinking water standard. Late last year, earlier this year, USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, put out a national survey. It's like 10 years of national survey data looking at streams and groundwater, and they found that in agricultural regions, they were detecting pesticides 90% of the time, and agricultural watersheds, the levels exceeded benchmarks for aquatic health or drinking water standards like two-thirds of the time. So we have serious pesticide problems, not just in California, but around the country. And of course, in the Farm Belt, in the Corn Belt, in the Midwest, we have a real crisis with atrazine. Atrazine contamination is widespread. This is another graphic pulled out of that USGS report that I mentioned. And it's an estimate of atrazine concentration in surface waters. And what you see in the sort of yellowish area are atrazine levels that are probably high enough to impact, you know, very sensitive species like frogs, for example. I think at one part per million, you get hermaphroditic frogs. And what you see here is that some of the states with, you know, they're right at the epicenter of this are not investing in pest management. In addition to not investing in pest management, we're also concerned that a lot of our EQIP programs around the country are not assuring that the quality of the pest management projects are high. In other words, we couldn't tell by looking at how the data was spent or at how the funds were allocated that there was real prevention-based integrated pest management happening. For example, in a couple of states, the folks on the ground told us, well, yeah, we fund pest management. We helped some farmers buy a lot of pesticides. And that was the extent of it. There are lots of other EQIP ranking criteria or payment rates which have sort of a single generic category called pest management at, you know, $5 an acre. And there's just no way to know that, you're getting scouting or record keeping or pheromone products or beneficial insect habitat promotion or any of the higher level, more prevention-based practices that we'd want to see. So our conclusion is that in addition to not spending a lot of money on pest management, we're not seeing a lot of sophistication on average or assurance that we're actually getting high-level, prevention-based integrated pest management. This has been talked about already today. There's no requirement for technical assistance providers to have expertise in integrated pest management. The requirement is to be licensed to apply pesticides and to have a credential from the ASA, Agronomy Society of America, and to go through an online NRCS web course, which is an overview of how the program works and some basic practices and basic concepts. But none of those credentials are sufficient to know that the TSPs who are registered actually have expertise in the kind of higher level practices that you all have dedicated your professional careers to. So with that as our findings, the recommendations that we list here are going to sound familiar to some of the ones you've heard today. We believe that we need more leadership in the agency to revisit ranking criteria to increase the amount of pest management. A critical strategy for doing that is to recognize the multiple benefits of pest management. In a lot of instances, we found that pest management practices would give a producer points for water quality, but there was no recognition for the fact that those practices might also improve habitat, soil quality, air quality. And when you actually recognize the multiple benefits, if your scoring system recognizes multiple benefits, that producer would get a lot more points for those advanced pest management practices. The payment levels is also really important. And again, the specialty crops issue that Larry was talking about comes into play here. You're not going to get specialty crop producers very interested in pest management assistance at $5 an acre. You just can't do that. In California, I think, pear growers, for example, probably spend closer to $1,000 an acre. And even in field cropping systems, you probably need to do more than that. To assure and to record and document that you are advancing pest management practices and moving toward a biocontrol prevention-based end of the spectrum, you need to be paying growers more for adopting the higher performing practices. And that just makes sense. That's good for growers and it's good for NRCS because then the agency can demonstrate they're actually funding more higher level practices. The technical service program needs to be calibrated for integrated pest management. The existing requirements are not enough. We need to be doing more sophisticated measuring overall so that we're actually documenting that more growers are adopting more advanced IPM practices. So as Mark Fairley says, we're not just tracking the number of dollars that we spend on the program, which is a very crude metric, clearly. And then lastly, the partnerships that have been talked about here today, and there's been a lot of discussion between NRCS and CSREES are critical. We're not going to get the resources we need at NRCS to do this thoroughly, and people like Mark have to implement this program with woefully inadequate resources, and they have to implement other programs on top of it. I mean, it is not a credible task, and the agency is going to have to invest more in getting that expertise. So let's just switch gears for 1 minute and talk about the Farm Bill. And here I agree and disagree with what Larry said earlier about the Farm Bill not being a place to promote integrated pest management. Unfortunately, CropLife, the Association of Pesticide Manufacturers, believes that the Farm Bill is a good place to change pest management policy and successfully sponsored an amendment that is now lodged in the House Farm Bill that would prevent USDA from quote-unquote discriminating against specific pesticides or categories of pesticides. And our attorneys have looked at this and it's been corroborated by informal conversations with NRCS staff and our analysis is that this will tie USDA's hands in trying to mitigate a particular bad actor pesticide. So for example, this will either directly or through a chilling effect, through intimidating NRCS employees, will prevent the agency from picking an atrazine, for example, and trying to focus on that pesticide and helping growers adopt alternatives to that. One of the definitions of discriminate in the Webster's Dictionary is simply to discern or to distinguish. So that is going to be resolved in conference committee, possibly before the end of the year, most likely early next year. The chairs of both the House and Senate Ag Committees are going to be wrestling with this question. So that's really the end of my talk. Just real quick, the report is called More IPM, Please, and it's available on NRDC's website. You can find it just by Googling More IPM, Please, and NRDC, and I did bring a few extra copies if anybody wants one.
Any questions? Let's start with Dave. You made the point number 5 you had on the number 2 report. It was measuring success. Do you have any suggestions on how to do that?
I do.
Suggestions?
Yeah, so the question was, do I have any suggestions for how to measure success? There's actually a requirement, as I understand it now, in the Section 595 standard for all conservation plans to include an IPM or a pest management component. To the extent that NRCS is asking growers to do conservation plans nationally, I think it would be interesting to ask producers to record how much pesticides they're using and whether or not they reduced any pesticides by particular amounts, and to aggregate that and to be able to tell that story as a at the state or national level. The agency recently issued a grant to the IPM Institute of North America to develop a pesticide hazard model, which would be a tool to score the relative risks or hazards of different pesticides. And you could use a tool like that to score a particular program. You could score the pesticides that get used and document the hazard score dropping over time as a result of program implementation. So I would look to real performance-based metrics and try to work with that.
Yes, I'd like to know if, let's say next summer, 2008, after the Farm Bill does to settle the stuff, is the glass still going to be half empty, in your opinion, knowing
On pest management?
Yeah, from point of view of a person who's supposed to implement pest management on a statewide basis, is that going to be better for me next year, or not?
I think it will be mixed. I mean, again, looking in the crystal ball, the Farm Bill's not over, and there's this Goodlatte Amendment out there, which has a very good chance of surviving the process. I think that is going to make your life harder, but you may have a little bit more money in EQIP, for example, or the Conservation Security Program, so there might be more money in the system, and there may be a few reforms that would push the agency to be more performance-based in how the money gets spent. But I don't think there's going to be, a big impact other than those. No, I don't think it'll have any impact on tracking or reporting, but what it could do is prevent the agency from picking a particular pesticide or a category of pesticides and saying, let's solve that problem. So, for example, if you have a Clean Water Act total maximum daily load cleanup plan, which is required under the Federal Clean Water Act for pesticide-impaired water bodies, and the impairment is caused by organophosphate pesticides, that language could prevent NRCS from saying, okay, let's pay growers to switch away from OP pesticides. If under that language, if I was a pesticide manufacturer, I could come in and say, whoa, whoa, you're discriminating against my products.
Could you get around that, though, with the reduced risk idea for as well? Where you just say, no, you only want products that are on the reduced risk or the replacement guidelines, or you're not saying specifically you don't want to fight your queries, you don't want OPs, but those are not products that have made that registration. Is that getting around there?
That might, but that would reduce your ability to go after the one chemical or the category of chemicals that you really want to focus on.
If I may add a comment, I've looked at that, and to me, minimally, it muddles the waters tremendously. So when you're trying to build partnerships and moving on those fronts, there's one more thing they have to consider as you're trying to develop these relationships, and that's at a minimum of my particular fear of that amendment.
Mike, can I offer two pieces of information? One is, if there's the genesis of how this whole thing came up, irrespective of whether you consider it a good or bad idea, which I don't agree with, the genesis of it was an action under CS, Customer Security Program, where under that program, I don't know if it was a state office or a local office, you may know this, Jonathan. OPRA was that they could not use atrazine in any circumstances in order to have a contract. The magistrates in Jenta said, wait a second, if they're using it according to the label, why are we taxpayer dollars to tell people not to use things for illegal reasons? And they registered protest with the USCIS office in Washington. It wouldn't surprise, so there was some experience in the pesticide industry with that kind of situation. Whether in fact that was the exact genesis of it or not, that was certainly an experience in the industry there. So that's what it did on the industry. But the other thing from Dave's point of view, we've been real careful. We were told early on in our programs that prior to this Good Light Amendment being adopted on our side, that it made more sense in terms of providing the incentive payment to say what growers were going to do, and NRCS did not want to be in the position of choosing one pesticide versus another. This is a little more risk, this is a little bit higher risk. And since some pesticides pose dietary risk from no biological risk or other ways around, NRCS didn't want to be in a position of choosing one, making pesticide that was expensive but it could be used if they were using it for the population. So what we've done, I think, in all lower the states, is talk about what it is we're going to do that justifies the research benefit that we get from a specific practice. I sure hope that's not getting better.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the question is, the context is we are giving public funds to private for-profit entities, and should we be should we be doing that if it's perpetuating, an environmental problem? And should we not, should we force the agency to not be able to, or prevent the agency from being able to, get in there and solve specific problems? There was a great example in Ohio, I actually sort of glossed through this, but There have been several very exciting success stories around the country, and we've heard about Michigan today, we've heard about your work, Larry. One of these other states is Ohio, where the city of Columbus's drinking water reservoir was contaminated with atrazine. The city was facing the gauntlet of having to build a new treatment plant to deal with this. And instead, the city went to NRCS and launched an EQIP program that was tailored to atrazine and targeted to the growers surrounding this watershed. And over several thousand acres, growers bought into the program and reduced their atrazine use, adopted best management practices, and over a couple of years drastically lowered the atrazine levels in the drinking water, saving the city millions of dollars in avoided treatment costs, right? It's exactly the kind of story that we all want to hear about. But I think that that would arguably be discriminating against atrazine under this language.
Okay, Jonathan, thank you very much.